Good morning, Open Door.
Morning.
Boy, it's great to be back here. I remember you people. Wow. Thanks. Thank you for saying that. And you were the new guy. Yeah. You were the remnant who couldn't get out of town and have to stay in this flaming inferno of heat. Stay here as long as you like. We're going to keep the AC on all day for you and show Laurel and Hardy movies. Open to chapter 4 of Ephesians. I got to update you. We've been traveling a lot, and Bill, Bruce, and I with True Face, and man, we just had this incredible experience last week. There's some friends of ours in Tulsa, Doug and Nadine Houston and their family. They're just their kids, and they have embraced this message. They've sat right here in church before as they came out for an intensive. They understand these truths, and they just love True Face, and they love Open Door. And they are our friends, and have become dear friends to us. So we, all three couples, were flown out for a conference and some meetings and some different projects we had to do and some writing for we're doing the 2.0 version of True Face. And but they said, come out, would you please, and do all that, but then take a couple days to go to Grand Lake, and we have a lakeside house there, and would you just stay there, and we'll get out of your hair as much as we can, and just let the three couples hang out together, be together, and just relax. That is wonderful. One of the things that they did was said, you guys, we've hired a guide to take you fishing for Bill, Bruce, and I. And, I mean, unbelievable. So one day, we got up, left our little slip. Doug Houston, his son-in-law, Jeff Hutzel, wonderful guy. And we drove up to the next slip, which was where Bill and Bruce were staying. And I want to show you a picture, because it was like 5:45 in the morning. It was so beautiful. Look at that. Look at that. With the sun here hitting the ground. And this is Nadine from up above at the lake house shooting down to us. We were just shouting out worship and shouting. I'm howling like an animal. And so that beautiful piece took place. And then we went fishing. Now, let's change from that beautiful feeling that you have there and change into... Well, no, that's still too nice. But thank you. Listen, let's get something clear. I can't fish, all right? I can't fish at all. I mean, I'm a terrible fisherman. Bill, on the other hand, is a great fisherman. He loves fishing. Jesus, grace, fishing. So they're Jesus is surely there. Even when he's speaking to you, he's just thinking about fishing. That's all he does. He just loves it. And Bruce is just... I don't know how he does it. He's busy all the time, but he's better at everything than everyone else. But I can't fish. I have no sensors in my hands. They always say, now the bass is grabbing. He's opening his mouth. And when you can feel him sucking the bait, pull. And I don't ever feel that. Whatever that is, I never feel. Till like 5 days later, I'll be laying in bed and go, oh, yeah. By that time, the big fish has cut up the worm for all the children fish. I can't fish, okay? So we're going, but this time they say, it's going to be different, John. You have a guide, and you're going to catch some fish. And I said, you know what? That's not going to happen. I can spoil a lake. And so we went, and I thought we were all going to be on one boat together, but there were too many of us, and so they split us up. And there was clearly the A boat. Tony, the actual head guide, who's just a massive man who in his picture holds a bass like the size of a bass. And he's got Wendy sponsoring his bass boat because he's a professional fisherman. I'm not on that boat. I'm over with Jeff Hutzel in another boat, and he's brought another guide with him who's a man in his early 100s. His name is Hank. And he has there's no Wendy's endorsement on his boat. And he just looks like a man who's not going to make it through the day. I'm thinking, how do I get the boat back once we're out there? So we go, we head on out. It doesn't look like he knows where he's going. And we go out and we catch a couple little sunfish looking fish at first. And then we sit there. He's a really nice guy, really sweet man. He's had time to practice. I mean, he's old. I'm sitting there, I'm thinking, I'm getting skunked with a guide. This is legendary. Who can fish as badly as me? And anyways, at one point, after about 2 hours, he says, guys, I want to try one more place. And he drives us over to another spot, and he's telling us about the limestone quarry that was built on this thing and how it angles out and the fish can feed into it, but they haven't been there all year long. And he says, I just have a feeling that maybe something's going to happen today. And I'm thinking, you don't know who's with you. And then he says, let's do this. Let's do this. I want us to bob our... We've got a lure. It's like a sardine, like a aluminum-looking sardine with little hooks on it. There's no bait on it. It's just a piece of metal. And he says, let's bob that off the bottom. And I'm thinking, he's just given up. Well, what are we going to do? What am I going to hit the fish on the head and make him mad? What am I going to do? And then, I got one. He's angry. I said, no, I'll just spin cast. Thank you. I'll be fine. And within moments, these two, Jeff and the guide Hank, pull up these enormous bass. I mean, at the same time. And I went, why don't I try the other pole? Guys, within minutes, we are all catching fish. We can't stop catching fish. There's just fish all over. We are catching. Within an hour, I catch over 20-some fish. And I threw it. We do not want to tell Bill's boat about where we are. But Hank, the moral compass in the boat, the pastor won't tell them, but Hank. Hank will. He calls them, and they show up. Here comes Bill and the Wendy's bass boat, and all of them, Bruce and Doug and Tony, and we are catching fish like we're like, we're just throwing things in. At one point, Hank's helping me with the fish. His pole is taken out to sea by another giant bass. We're all catching as they come up. We're just, Jeff's got two hands going with poles. And Bill just looks at me like, there is no God. Literally, I could hear, I could just hear his expression. At one point, I catch a 12-incher. I go, this is too small. Let's throw it back. So for one day, God said, you've lived a miserable, fishless existence today, my friend. So, I won the fishing derby. Thank you very much. Gosh, was that fun. Man, that was like one of those movies that about two-thirds of the way through it, you're now not enjoying the movie because you love it so much that you don't want it to end. It was one of those, I know this one's never coming back again. I'm hitting fish on the head with a lure. Ephesians 4. Man, it's been so cool sitting here on the weeks that I've been here and getting to listen to the preachers handle these passages. And then David, this last week, handled a passage 17 through 21 that I'm going to refer to in a moment. But I thought, how do I want to approach this? There's times when I find myself not thinking right. You have it too. I during those times, I get into a mindset where I want to give up. I want to run. I want to get even. I want to blame. I want to commiserate and wallow in my stuff or talk down someone or check out, fail or medicate or prove or brag or self-defend or break commitments, or go passive, or attack, or wallow in my guilt and unworthiness and shame and despair. And then that moves into behaving not right. And I find myself losing my temper or gossiping or demeaning another or going passive or checking out or medicating or bragging or getting even or plotting to do wrong in hiddenness or accusing or giving myself permission to fail and becoming depressed. How did I get there? Huh? How did I get there? Well, probably something triggered what I might not be able in the moment name. I've known myself long enough now to know when I feel embarrassed or feel belittled or devalued or made fun of, it triggers something in me. When I feel inadequate, or I've failed too many times, or someone has betrayed me, or prayer doesn't get answered the way I thought that it was supposed to get answered, or I feel alone or left alone or abandoned or not important and not thought of or about, or I go through hurt long enough, or there's a series of continuing unfortunate events, it triggers something in me that gives me a permission to think wrong that eventually gives me a permission to act out wrong. So how do I get back when I get there? And I can give you my list of the wrong ways to get back. I can, sometimes I just don't. I just stay there. And I just have learned to just stay there until something lifts, until somebody does something about their part in everything. Or I resolve to get... I'm going to get back on my game. I'm going to create a list of good things that will get me back in the game. Or I'll tell myself, come on now. I got to be better. Or tell myself I shouldn't be this sad. Come on, after all you have, look at the people who have, and I do that. Or I preach at myself, John, be more like Jesus. Come on. Or I hide what I'm feeling and what I've done and I put on a mask. I don't know, what else? I get self-serving where I go out and entertain myself and just try to find something to fill that void. Or I eat like a man who's not eaten in weeks. Or I do something spiritual to let God know I'm serious. I have tried all week to have something other than this be the visual that I would use, and there is nothing else for me to use. I've one time, long time ago, brought these out for you. These are coats. And hopefully today, they will help us have a visual that we may not ever forget that can bring us home. For God never appeals to something you should do to get yourself back when you get in this place. He appeals to how you must see you and how you must see Him to get back home. You see, there is a self that was, and there is a self that now is. And though the old self that was will never again be who you are if you are a believer who has trusted Jesus in faith by His death on the cross and His resurrection to bring you to Him and make you born again, though that old self will never again be who you are, it can be put back on. And it will result in similarly destructive patterns. Nearly every time you find yourself wandering down a wrong road, you did not get there simply by temptation or because you haven't cared enough or done enough or disciplined yourself enough. Temptation worked because pain hit the right spot and it caused you to lose confidence in the new self. And you reverted to the twisted comfort of the old self. And so he talks about two selves. In 22 through 24, he's talked about, don't be like the Gentiles. Remember, there's a way that they saw life because they're lost. They didn't know any better. Remember that list from that David took us through in 17 through 19? He says they were trapped in the futility of their mind, only what their mind could think. They had no enlightenment, no discernment, no wisdom, just their thinking. And they got trapped by perseverating over and over again on wrong thoughts. They were darkened in their understanding. They just couldn't see clearly, like people wandering around in the dark. They were excluded from experiencing the life of God. They were ignorant. It wasn't that they were stupid. They were just ignorant. And they had hardness of heart. They became tough and cynical and sarcastic and mocking. It eventually made them fully callous. And then they gave themselves permission, why not, to partake in sensuality of all wrong forms. And eventually, it says, in full-blown, they practice immaturity with greediness. They were greedy to be impure. And now, here we are in Ephesians 4:22. He says, you're not like the non-believing Gentiles. He says, you guys, in verse 22, in reference to your former manner of life, I want you to do something that's already been done, but you have to agree to it. I want you to do something that has already been done the moment you trusted what Jesus did on the cross, but you will have to agree to it. I want you to lay aside the old self, which is being presently corrupted in accordance with the lusts of deceit, and that you, being renewed in the spirit of your mind, put on the new self, which is in the likeness of God, has been created in righteousness and holiness of the truth. You are asked to take off what's already been taken off, and you're asked to put on that which is already completely irreversibly me. It's a once and for all event that happened to you. Remember back in Romans 6:6, where he says, know this, that our old self was crucified with him in order that our body of sin might be done away with so we would no longer be slaves to sin. Now, old means in this case not in the past so much as old as in useless and worthless. This is my old coat. Mike was asking me, I got it when I was 20. This coat's 38 years old. And I've held on to it all these years. In this coat, I so much wanted to be someone great. I thought I was going to be this hippie guy who would be so loved, and I didn't know who I was. I was messed up. I was scared. I was trying to impress people. I was faking. I was trying so many different masks to prove to you that I wasn't pitiful, that I was enough, that I was worthy of being loved. I did a lot of dope in this coat. I did a lot of acid. I used a lot of people. And I wandered out in the desert and I would sing songs, calling out, hoping that something would answer, something that would mean something to my life. It says that I am to lay all that, all those memories, all that futility of mind darkening my understanding, excluded from the experience of the life of God, the ignorance that was in me, the blind passions that would do wrong so fast, the hardness of heart, the way I mocked people and made fun of people who were not like me, the callousness that I had, the permission to sensuality that didn't even fit me, the practicing of impurity with greediness. It says, lay aside the old self. He's saying that there is this thing inside of me, flesh, Paul calls it in Romans 7, that still animates a craving to put back on that which will never have the right to be my true clothing. Hurts, revenge, history, allurement, obsession, generational dysfunction. And that very list that we read out of 17 through 19, it's crazy. It starts reanimating. Isn't that crazy? This one who's a new creature, I can choose. And that list will begin to reanimate once I give myself permission to put back on the coat. I've put it on a lot of times, by the way. It's interesting. I still keep it. And when I have it on, even now, I feel that coldness and that darkness again. And I feel all the people that I hurt. And I feel all the deep, deep, lonely, empty, not knowing who John Lynch was and wondering if he would ever be enough and trying so hard to prove that he was. And the shame and the embarrassment, I still feel it. I still put it on. I put it on when an event or a series of events makes me lose confidence in my new coat. It still has present power to corrupt me. Verse 22 says, being corrupted. Whenever this coat's on, it's still... And when I get hurt, it... Doggone it, it brings surprising comfort to wear it. It's sick, it's twisted, but in some ways it almost gives me comfort to put it back on. It gives me the permission and entitlement to not care, to not love. It returns me to a place where I won't be wounded by hope. It creates passionate, wrong responses to defend myself. And when I put it on, I choose to put Jesus out there. And I am down here feeling let down and not cared for, doing this largely alone. And the moment I put it on, something gets twisted. Deception starts to speak lies into me again. Remember, that's what it says here. That's the very banner of this, is the lust of being corrupted with the lust of deceit. Lust is simply the word passion. To be excited, to be fervent about something. Wow! So I'm getting corrupted by deception, false information now that's coming to me. And now I'm buying it with a fervor. Intense passions formed of deceit. That's what the fabric of this coat is. I've been deceived and now I'm passionate about it. It hurls me in a wrong direction with fervor. It repaints my landscape. Deceived that this passion for sensuality and greed and selfishness and life with God at the center will somehow satisfy me. It won't look like it did. I won't do dope like in the old days, but the patterns will still be the same. It will still begin to harm my life. Oh, guys, if you could just sneak into my head and into my heart, you'd see how quick my tapes reanimate when I give myself permission to put this on. It's crazy! I'll never be unredeemed John again, but it is amazing how quickly I form absurd self-logical rationalizations and justifications and permissions as soon as I choose to throw off my trust of the new life and grab back at the old coat. I'll defend my reasoning with every bit of my being and all of my articulateness and all of my loudness. I'll fight that I am right. And I'll wish, I wish so much, no I don't, because it would be so sad for you to hear what my wife and friends have to hear when I start up my litany. When I go into that place where I have put on the coat and now the deceit has started up the lies and I bought it with passion and somehow I see Stacy as the enemy or I see someone else as the enemy and I see myself as the innocent victim. Do you know Stacy used to just didn't know what to do with me. She would try to reason with me. Anymore now she's on to me. She understands it's the old coat. And she just goes, hey, knock it off. And where's my husband? Bring him back. Because she knows exactly what's taking place. She really does do that, by the way. And then there's this. My new coat. New not as in age, but as in usefulness and beauty and wonderful and magical and purposeful. This coat, in fact, this is different than the one I used the last time. One time that I flew, I took the good coat and left in the overhead compartment on a plane flight, and it's gone. I don't know what that says theologically about me. But this really is my new coat. For this coat, in this coat, this is, you know me in this coat. I am safe in this coat. My new life has been manifest in this coat. I have sung so many songs to Jesus in this coat. I have held all my children in this coat. And I have laughed with you and played with you. And I've written scripts. I've written messages in this coat. I've sat around a fireplace dreaming about what life could look like for my kids and for my friends in this coat. This is my new coat. And when after it's been, when I've forgotten that it's who I am, and I've taken this stupid coat for any period of time and worn it, when I put this back on, I feel Jesus. I experience Jesus. I feel Jesus with me. In me, I feel Jesus around me and over me and through me and beside me and indwelling me and deeply, deeply in love with me and empowering me and defining me and defending and protecting and caring for me. I'm home. And all I have to do is believe what was done once and for all is really true right now on my worst day. You see, the banner, remember? The banner was this. The banner on the old self was this, corrupted in accordance to the lusts of deceit. And now the banner on the new coat, you see it in verse 24. In the likeness of God. Christ in John, fused with John, not knowing where one begins and one drops off. No, just when you think it stops, it's created, the fabric of it that never goes off is created in complete and full righteousness. The threads are righteousness and holiness of the truth. It's all over Scripture, huh? When Paul says, if anyone's in Christ, he's a new creature. The old things have passed away. Behold, new things have come. And then he makes this incredible statement. He, God, made him, Jesus, who never knew any sin, to actually become sin on my behalf, that I would become the actual righteousness of Christ in him. Always. Irreversible. Unchangeable. Philippians says the same thing. When Paul calls out, I could tell you all sorts of stuff about me that you might want to brag on me, but here's what I want. I want to be found in him, not having a righteousness of my own from what I could drum up and how good I could be from the law. I want that righteousness that comes from believing it's true, that comes from faith in Christ, that the righteousness that comes from God on the basis of faith. And then in Galatians he says, I have been crucified with Christ. The old John Lynch doesn't exist, but Christ lives in me. And the life that I live now, that I live in this skin now, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself up for me. This, believing this, is what brings me home. Knowing that this is on me, choosing intentionally to put this on me, is what brings me home when I get into that crazy, weird, strange thought pattern that I don't know how to get out of. To choose to believe this about you, that you are actually righteous. Not just judicially, but actually and holy. Not condemned, not judged, fully enough right now. This is my position. This is what is on me all the time. This is what we mean by believing our identity. This is how I deal with sin. To choose to receive the love of God fully, because he not only completely loves me, but he really likes me and sees me as fully clean, fully justified, fully enough. To choose to believe that I am filled with love that I can give away. Now, listen, this doesn't, when we talk about this, it doesn't excuse our sin. I still trust him in repentance to face my wrong. I still make amends to those I hurt. I still own my responsibility of my failures. This simply is what keeps me from the next entitlement, the next justification, the next stumble, the next fall, the next result of seeing myself as a disappointing son or daughter because of my sin. We so often hear people say, well, you guys keep talking about this identity stuff and this grace stuff. Well, where's effort? When do I got to do some stuff? And what they mean by that is, where's the effort? Aren't you supposed to work on your sin? And the answer is, knock yourself out. Good luck. It won't do anything. If you want to give effort, there's incredible effort in the Christian life. Incredible effort. Two areas. First, to live out this new love that is in us. To love the unlovely and the needy. It takes a lot of effort. Even though I have Christ's love in me, it takes a lot of sacrifice and effort to love well. It takes a lot of energy. It costs a lot to love well. That's where effort should be given. And secondly, effort should really be given to keep on the new coat when it doesn't seem to fit. To keep on the new coat when it doesn't seem to work. That takes unbelievable effort. Because sometimes there's pain. You guys, there is a form of pain that still comes whether you're wearing the old coat or the new coat. Pain wants to make a coward out of us. You remember, I don't know if you saw on my Facebook page, I put up a post that I borrowed from someone else's page from C.S. Lewis. He makes this statement, Lewis does, we're not necessarily doubting that God will do the best for us. We're just wondering how painful the best will turn out to be. You see, the pain will be there either way, but it seems to hurt a lot less if trusting God's protection and love was not part of the original equation. Because I won't feel so let down. So all this will get tested. You'll say the words right, you'll believe the words right, and then it will all get tested. And see, what we're learning to do, this is not a once and for all thing. It's like we're learning a swing, and we're learning to trust it under pressure. Because pressure will come. Because you're not used to trusting God that you really are this incredible creation. It sounds not right. It just sounds like I don't deserve it. Or that He would love you like He says He does when you don't feel like it or when you don't feel worthy of it. And we were thinking about it in True Face. We were writing about a golf swing. When we started, how do you describe trying this on? And we wrote, so let's say you're working on a new swing, your old swing, while decent looking enough and capable of producing occasional good shots, it just really isn't working. For decades, you've been paying a lot of money to play really bad golf with a golf swing built on the conviction, the harder you swing, the more effort you give, the further the ball will go. And this theory has been proven false every round you've ever played. So you decide to take lessons. The golf pro comes, highly recommended. He tells you he's going to completely revamp your swing. He convinces you it's the way to go, but he sternly warns you at the end of the lessons that you'll now have to trust it and risk it under pressure before it'll ever be of any use to you. He cautions you that you'll be tempted to revert to your old familiar swing the first time you get into a club tournament or someone puts a few bucks on the round. Well, you assure him that you didn't spend money on lessons to revert to a bad golf swing. And he repeats the caution several times. But you smile, full of hope, ready to shoot your best round ever. Well, one day you're out on a course with your buddies trying the new swing, and you are having a blast. Shots are launching at angles and distances you've never seen. Your buddies notice and praise your shots in glowing terms you've never before heard. You discover by hole 15 you're on course for the round of your life. On 16, you hit a good drive, but a bad bounce puts you in a divot behind some trees with a small opening. And suddenly that old voice starts talking to you. Here you go again. We've been here how many times? You get here and then you fail. You've been here before. You failed the last several hundred attempts, and now with your friends watching, you're going to trust that new swing? Snap hook, for sure. And so you panic. And you revert into survival mode. You're suddenly more confident of your old swing than the new. And one of your buddies whispers to the others, well, there goes this round. And you opt for the 1 in 100 shot. If I just try harder, if I just concentrate harder, I can muscle this shot through the opening. And the next thing you remember, you're tapping in for a 9. And you follow it up with an 8. And in the parking lot, taking off your golf shoes, you're confronted with this thought, I'm never going to get better. I am never going to get better. Those lessons were an absolute waste of time. The next day, your clubs are being offered on eBay. It matters. It matters incredibly, but it's not enough for it to be true that this coat is on me all the time. It matters what you believe about it. See, righteousness, you guys, it is not something out there that someday with enough perseverance you might just get a little bit of. Righteousness is not just something Jesus has that you only get judicially stamped so that you'll look good for heaven. Righteousness has been created in you as a gift. It cannot and will not be taken from you. You are actually, if you are a believer in Jesus Christ, fully righteous. I don't know how to say that better. Completely, absolutely, like in total, without any hint of not all of it, you are. Not just imputed, but actually are. Now, he says that's who you are. Righteous means upright. Always, not crooked. It means to be morally right. And you are holy. It means set apart from corruption. You are morally pure. Guys, it is time we get this. This is the present glory and wonder of the cross and the resurrection of Jesus. Excluded, vain, darkened, futile, ignorant, callous, sensuality-driven, impure, greedy ones are made clean and alive and pure and beautiful, love-inhabited, righteous, holy ones. Why is this such a big deal? Why does this all crescendo here in chapter 4 in these words? Why has he told us all of who we are in him? Because I can be fully free and choose to not experience freedom. Because I can be fully filled with God and not experience it. Because my old coat remains nearby, one series of disappointments away. Because the old coat has nostalgic familiarity and a twisted comfort to it. Because when it's upon me, the old coat traps me back into patterns of sin, and I become stupid again. Well, how do I learn to trust this new life in me then? How do I learn to keep this coat on me? Well, I just told you that you were absolutely, actually righteous and holy, but let's be honest, we're not mature in it. Just like that butterfly that we talk about who has the DNA of righteousness, it takes a while for it to be visibly manifest. And so I want to mature. I want to mature in these truths. If he says this is the difference maker, then I want to mature. I've got to believe these truths and live them out in daily life under pressure and temptation when things go wrong. He says here, and over in Romans 12, that I have to allow my thinking to be retaught. Because I have this built-in religious thinking that says, don't you dare buy that. You're going to get in trouble believing that. You don't deserve that. One day, maybe, that stuff is in there. So I have to retrain my thinking. This is the beauty of Romans 12. I love that section in 12 where he says, don't be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. So here I am with this coat fully on me. He says, don't be conformed. Conformed means to wear an external appearance, an expression that is not the real you. Don't put on something, don't conform by putting over the real you something that's not the real you. Don't let me see the appearance of something that isn't you anymore. But be transformed. That literally means to let me see what's inside, to allow visibly the inward you to be made outward. Be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Be transformed. Let come out that which is really true about you. To do that, you're going to have to let your mind be transformed. You're going to have to let your mind be renewed. Renewed is in the passive, and it means to allow yourself to be continually renewed by another, by God, by His Holy Spirit and others convincing you that this is true on your worst day. See, a huge part of maturity, isn't it, is learning to be able to recognize when I've taken off my new coat and I've put on my old. Or to have friendships that can recognize and that you give permission to tell you where Stacy will say, where's my husband? I want him back. Knock it off. To have people in my life like a Bruce, like a Bill, like so many others in this room that I have who can say, John, what's going on? And I will have to stop believing some things too. I will have to stop believing nice-sounding religious cliches that are not true. Like this one. I said, I've got to give up the dead theology that there's something I can do to get more of Jesus. I was speaking recently, just about to get up in a church, and the worship leader said these words that you hear them all the time. And they sound so good, and as soon as he says them, everybody goes, yes, yo, oh yeah, yeah, mm. It's this. We know that I want less of me, more of Jesus. No, it sounds so good. It's inane. It is inane. No, here's inane. It has to improve to get up to inane. The cross has failed if the sum total of the work of this life must mean that somehow we eradicate the one that he made in delight. If somehow,
less of John, don't feel so much, don't enjoy food, don't be funny, be humble. We want less of John. Until he's a wee little guy. And he doesn't think much or feel much, and at a party he goes like this.
Less of John! No, can we just be biblical for a second? He wants way more of John, who has been religiously tied down. He wants Christ in John, with all of his personality, all of his playfulness, all of his creativity, all of his imagination, all of his love, every bit of it coming out. That's the glory of God. It's Christ in John. And by the way, less of John. Let that be a warning to the rest of you. I'll follow you like an animal. So let's go with the second half of the equation. Less of John, more of Jesus. Listen, guys. There isn't any more that he's holding out with Jesus. Come down, rain upon us, more of you, Jesus. He goes, I'm right here. Right here. I'm this old dwelling in you and everything. And didn't go anywhere. Completely, absolutely here. And you're not going to get more of me by... More! Still right here. Somewhere we're going to have to let that one die to believe this new clothing. Or I'll just keep putting on the old one that says, try harder, do more, go back to the old swing. I must give up the lie that I'm not actually righteous and holy. I must give up the lie that I am the sum total of my behaviors. And I must be taught and try on my new identity until I will risk it. And I must continually surround myself with those who will remind me. And I must learn to see the scriptures with grace-conditioned eyes. And I must keep returning to the cross to see that it purchased an ongoing righteousness and holiness that will protect me in failure and shame and hurt and guilt. So here's what it looks like. If I have this right, I would put my arms, to put it back on, I would to know and feel the experience of putting on what's already on, I would reach my arms back and slide them through the holes, and then pull it around me, and I might fold my arms at the end. So, you've been listening. If what these verses said are true, and it demands that I choose to put on what is already put on, then what do you say we do it? As we prepare to go to the table, say, Father, I'm tired. In this moment, that's all I can do. I'm tired of not believing this and trying to somehow impress you and be enough. And I imagine you would reach back and do this, and it's going to be tough because there's people next to you. I know that. And you would reach back and you'd pull your arms through and then pull that coat onto you. What do you say? Every one of us who names the name of Christ, would you do that? Right now, everybody. Reach back. Reach way back. Oh, you hit someone. Reach back. reach back, pull all the way, put your arms through the sleeves. Now pull back and around. And if you really believe it, you could fold your arm. Now, with God-conditioned eyes, with no more deceit, with clear view, with beauty, here's how we see Jesus. We see Him fully enjoying who you really are. We see Jesus. You see Jesus looking back after looking ahead into your future with a smile on His face. You see Jesus refusing to shake His head in derision or disgust. You see Jesus not meeting your promises, but you actually learning to receive His. You see Jesus absolutely comfortable with you. You see Jesus standing with you when you fail to restore you. You see Jesus noting every moment that His life in you is displayed. You see Jesus clapping His hands together and shouting a hoop when you risk believing your true identity and risk to put it on. You see Jesus loving you to the exact extent that His Father is loving Him. You see Jesus sobbing in joy as you allow yourself to receive His love. You see Jesus standing against every accusation brought against you in the moments of your worst failure. You see Jesus looking at your sin together, refusing to allow it to continue to harm you, but refusing to allow it to define you. And you see Jesus in you and around you and over you and through you and part of you and beside you and indwelling you and empowering you and defining you. I can see it on you. And you look incredible.